We are glad to make all of our JCast Network podcasts free for our listeners. However, they are not free to produce and host. Please consider making a donation to JCast Network to help support our work by visiting jcastnetwork.org/donate. Thanks for your support.
לקח אלפי שנה, הנה זה כבר בטוח, תנו להיכנס. Welcome to the Jewish Hour. I'm your host, Herschel Finman. We've got a wonderful show for you. In this half hour, we're going to be speaking with the authors of a really fascinating book. The book is called Ashkenazi Herbalism. Yes, and it's written by Dietrich Cohen and Adam Siegel. And this is what talking about ethnography. This is like way cool. This is like, yeah, you're going to want to listen to this one. The portion of the week is the portion of Emor. It is found in chapter 21 of the book of Leviticus and following. We've got a cappella music scattered throughout the show, and we might just talk about why that is this week. We may have time. We've got this amazing Baal Shem Tov story, which ties in with Lag BaOmer. Lag BaOmer is Friday, Thursday night, Friday, and we'll talk about a little bit about that also, if God willing, with the time. Before we do anything else, let's go right to the news. Riots near Jerusalem's Old City have been ongoing since the start of Ramadan. Arabs protested Israel's occupation of Jerusalem, while Jews counter-protested. Dozens of people were injured and over 70 people were arrested on both sides. Police used skunk and tear gas and stun grenades to break up the crowd. Syria launched a missile that landed in an empty area south of Jerusalem. I don't know why anybody's not making anything. This is Syria, which is way up in the north, and it launched a missile which lands in Jerusalem, which is in the center of the country, and it was overshot its mark. It's a miracle to me. Israeli Air Force planes destroyed the battery from where the missile was launched, and four other sites. Four people were injured in Syria. Two rabbis were attacked by a mob in the streets of Jaffa. Police arrested two people. One of the rabbis required hospitalization. Rabbi Nissen Goldman, Chabad rabbi of the University of Cape Town, rescued a Torah scroll from his burning synagogue. Wildfires have been ongoing in Cape Town. Many buildings have already been destroyed. In reported acts of anti-Semitism this week, vandals smashed at least 10 gravestones in Belfast, Northern Ireland. A van backed into a group of Hasidic men in the Williamsburg, Brooklyn area section and sped away. The driver was later caught and charged with a hit and run, but not a hate crime. Swastikas were spray painted on a playground in West Haverstraw, New York, and anti-Israel slogans were spray painted at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. Israel and Greece signed a defense agreement, which includes Israel creating a flight school for the Greek Air Force. And finally, very disturbing story. I'd like to end on a good note, but this is a disturbing story. A Dutch museum is offering $240,000 to the heirs of the owner of a painting which was made in 1635. Dutch law says that paintings that are known to be looted Nazi property do not have to be returned to the owners or the families of the owners. The museum just needs to pay something. At auction, this painting would sell for 10 times the going price. And that's the news.
Some of the best jobs in the world are in the radio and television industry, and you too can join the workforce in as little as 8 months when you complete your hands-on training at the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts located in Southfield, Michigan. At Specs Howard School, students get to play and learn at the same time. Imagine spending your class time behind the microphone, spinning music and hosting your own radio show, or designing and lighting a set for your own TV program, running a camera, learning to edit, directing a program. When you go to Specs, your day will be anything but dull. And if school is this fun, imagine how exciting it is to work in the growing industry. In addition, the credits you earn while attending Specs Howard School are currently accepted at 14 area colleges and universities. If you've always wanted the best job in the world, call for a tour of Specs Howard School at 248-358-9000. That's 248-358-9000, or visit them on the web at specshoward.edu. Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. This is where you start.
Herschel Finman here. You're listening to the Jewish Hour. We got some time coming up right now, so we're going to play a little music just to get you in the mood. This is the Malchus Choir. It's a group of young Hasidic men, and their song is called Nach Ein Shabbos. It's a cover from an old Mordechai Ben David song, and I like this version much better than the Mordechai Ben David version, and we're playing this one just for you.
De Shabbos als es greit, in Stieb schön alles klappt. De Tate läuft in Schiel, am Mikwelle gechabt. Der Chasen ist schon du, ich in der Rahmen nu. Beim Davenen, na jeder was an Bald noch ein Davenen, nahm sich jeder Geid. Sucht noch ein Teurele, in Maluchem wird begleit. Wie schein es lacht der Gas, socken schwarze was. Stirlech, spodig, stramlech, jeder sein Levis.
Ein Schabbes, noch ein Schabbes, lo mir ehrlich sein. Noch ein Schabbes in mir gehen nachheim, all der Gemure bastin, als Mashiach schon kin, wenn mir it nur up ein Schabbes koire schelle, wie es darf zu sein.
Noch ein Schabbes lo mir ehrlich sein. Noch ein Schabbes in mir gehen nachheim, weil der Gemure bastin, als Mashiach schon kin,
Im Yisruay Meshamri Shabbos Achas Keil Chuzos
Aside Essen Mir Jeder Zalne Min Bogen Lechovet Shabbos Fiel Barbirem Mishlal Vedogen Noch Aside Ageloi In Shilin Reben Soif Einer lernt, einer singt Koech Soif Neuem Bam Shachris Davenen, Kaludin sing de Kuhn. Nuch Mister Schrei de Shamesh.
A Kiddish Bam Ichul.
Nuch Aside Ashpatsi. Nenuch Eloift in Shir Tzim Shir.
Im Baish Ale Shires Vintani Groch Mitoyen.
Ein Shabbos, noch ein Shabbos, lo mir ehrlich sein. Noch ein Shabbos, im Irgayen nahein. Al degem ure bashtin, az Mashiach shoinkin, ve meit nor upein Shabbos koyresh ele vi es datzin zayn.
Nahoy, nochein Shabbos lo mir ehrlich sein. Nochein Shabbos im Irgayen ahein. Al degem ure bashtin, az Mashiach shoinkin.
Ilis ruay mishamrim Shabbos achas keil chuso.
Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier.
Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurance is accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800.
Yep, we're here.
Okay, that's much better. Okay, let me, if you can just, do you remember the question I asked?
Yeah, okay, and so, I will try okay, to so sum just, up as
okay, so just start talking.
Quickly as I can.
I'm going to stop talking. Okay. We're not going to just at this point, I just asked you the question, so you're just now going to answer it, and then we can edit out all the stuff in between. Okay?
Okay.
Go.
I went back to school after being a librarian for many years to study herbal medicine because it's something that I was really interested in for many, many years since I was a kid. And you might not have noticed, but there's kind of a resurgence in interest in herbal medicine, specifically, you know, in the Western world and very much in the United States. And so part of studying herbal medicine is learning your ancestral practices. And so being Ashkenazi on both sides, I was really excited to do the research, especially having been a librarian and being familiar with doing heavy-duty research. And so I, as soon as I started these classes, I was in a program in Berkeley. All of our assignments were kind of based on our ancestral practices and knowledge of that. So when I started to do the research, because I didn't know what my ancestral practices had been, and I was really interested in early 20th century, the time that my grandparents, who were from the Pale Settlement, both sides, would have known. So once I started trying to do that research, I came up empty-handed with anything that was more contemporary, around that time of the early 20th century, late 19th century. And so that was the spur for my program to work on all these projects that we were doing to try to uncover something. And I know you mentioned Bonkies, and that came up not only from something that my mother told me while I was doing this research that was completely unexpected, that my grandfather, he even had his own set of cups, which, you know, I was just totally fascinated by and excited by, because I had gone, you know, in recent years to see a Chinese a traditional Chinese practitioner, and she had put cupping on my back, and it just felt so good and so right. And I was just like, wow, I've been waiting for this experience my whole life. And little did I know that my own grandfather had been, you know, a practitioner of Bonkies.
Okay. Let me jump in. Speaking of your grandparents, do you, your parents, I'm assuming were people who came to this country from Europe?
On my father's side, they were from Ukraine, and they came over in the very early 20th century. And on my mother's side, they had stayed there in Poland until the outbreak of the war. And so they were survivors of World War II, and they spent my aunt was born in Italy, and my mom grew up in Italy, and they didn't come over to the U.S. until the very early 60s.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So yeah. The reason why I asked that is because I remember a couple of folk remedies that my grandmother used to do. Like, she would, if somebody had upper respiratory congestion, she would take...
I know what you're going to say. No, mustard plaster.
No. She didn't believe in that one. I did this once. I was like 5 years old, and I said that was cool. She would take a beet, okay, and she would roast the beet. And then she would cut the beet in half and kind of like scoop out the middle of the beet a little bit. And then she would fill in the cavity with honey and just let it sit on the back of the stove. And then after a period of time, she would take the honey with the beet, and then that was cough syrup. That was my bubby's cough syrup, for example. I don't know. It tasted good. I remember that.
It was probably very nutritious.
It was a whole lot better than Robitussin. And so I was asking, do you remember any of the folk remedies of your grandparents straight away without having like done major research into books that are real to you? Or maybe you, Adam.
Do you want to answer that?
No.
No, I feel like, do you want to say something?
No. I'll jump in. I mean, we've all had the honey remedies. The spoon, the raspberry syrup, the boogle muggle.
Yes.
Right. But, you know, that is probably the extent of, you know, plant-based medicine. Aside from food, you know, because food is medicine too. And, you know, we had a lot of chicken soup growing up.
Right.
But,
okay, you mentioned before. No. Let me jump in. You mentioned before this term, which maybe some of our listening audience is not familiar with, the Pale of Settlement. Could you describe what was the Pale of Settlement, please, just Deitra?
I'm going to let Adam answer that.
Sure, thank you. Yeah, the Pale of Settlement was, strictly speaking, that area of what was then Western Russia, the Western Russian Empire, where Jews were allowed to live beyond the Pale. That's where the phrase beyond the Pale comes from. They needed special permission. That was to live in the big cities like Moscow or St. Petersburg. So that's the historical home of most Ashkenazim. It roughly stretches from, say, just north of Vilna, goes all the way south to Odessa, the eastern side of the Dnieper River in Ukraine, almost out to Russia, around the towns of Kharkov, and then to the west to to the edge of Poland, where Poland and Germany and Poland and Czechoslovakia meet.
Okay.
And that's where, if you could, probably.
How many square miles would you say there was, or comparable? Was that about the size of Texas?
I think it's got to be bigger.
Bigger
I'm bad
Texas.
At the numbers, but it's probably, you know, hundreds of thousands of square miles.
Okay, and probably millions of Jews lived there, and that was the only.
Basically all of Ashkenazim, almost all of Ashkenazim, in the 1890s, probably 99% of Ashkenazim probably lived within the Pale of Settlement.
Okay.
By a handful of educated Jews who lived in places like Moscow, but the rest of them.
And that purpose of that was basically just to sequester the Jews in an area away from the non-Jewish population, correct?
Yeah, that's my really crude understanding. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Once Russia took over the lands that were once the Polish Commonwealth.
Okay. So Deidre Cohen and Adam Siegel. So you've got this assignment to develop herbal medicine remedies that were traditional to your ancestry. So how did you go about doing that?
So it's kind of a convoluted story because, you know, having been a librarian and knowing or thinking I knew how to do research generally and not finding anything, I was very frustrated.
If I can explain your frustration, when I saw the topic and I said, well, let's see what's out there on the web, I went to Google. Dr. Google has everything. And I typed in Ashkenazi herbal remedies. And the only thing that came up was your book.
Right. Yeah. So you can see what I was up against, especially, you know, when you make the assumption that, you know, that Google is going to have everything, you know, and you're searching in English. So that was my conundrum, you know, at the early stages. But I was very curious and I felt like there had to be something because, you know, a friend of mine in my class joked that, well, you know, at least we had chicken soup. It's a funny comment, but then she followed it up with, and if there wasn't anything else, it had to do with religious restrictions. And I should confess right now that I was not raised religiously and I've never been religious. So the comment kind of was like, how could that possibly be? It seems so illogical that, you know, an entire people wouldn't be allowed to use medicinal materials that were right in their midst. So I think that was like a real spur in my side. And so I was very just dogged, you know, I just had to find something. And every once in a while, I would come up with these like clues that were so unexpected and so exciting. And yet they didn't answer specific questions. And my specific questions were, what were the plants that they knew and how, you know, were they applied by the healers or the people who knew them? And so very early on, I would find things like I was looking in a Holocaust database. You might be familiar with it. And that's the U.S. Holocaust Museum. Mm-hmm. And it has a lot of images in it. And one of the images that I first found was a bottle. It looked like a milk bottle. And it was late at night. And I was, like I said, obsessed with this. And so I kind of like squinted at it and I zoomed in on it. And I was like, what is that? And it turned out to be a bottle of bitters. And if you're familiar with bitters at all, they're like an herbal extraction of a bitter plant, something like gentian or calamus or dandelion.
Yeah, horrible drinks. I know that, yes.
Right, right. But people use them now in like cocktails. So you'll find them at almost every bar, and like a lot of them are really like artisanal now. But, you know, in the olden days, people used them as like an aperitif to stimulate digestion, because what they do is, you say they're horrible, but they, if you think about a bitter and putting a bitter flavor in your mouth, the first thing that happens physically to you is you salivate. And once you start salivating, it supports your entire digestive tract all the way down. Your mucous membranes start secreting this like fluid that helps you to digest your food. And so this what I thought was a milk bottle was this bottle of bitters that was produced by a company called the Kantorowicz factory. And this was like a Jewish family in what's today Posen, Poland. And they made these bitters. And they were very, very successful. And they were only one of a handful of companies, I later found out, that were making bitters and other, you know, alcoholic beverages that included medicinal plants. So that was really exciting to find that. And that was just one of the little clues that I found. And yet, you know, I was like, if I could find this, I had to keep going. And it kind of like snowballed from there. And but little tiny, tiny drips and drabs. And one of the pieces that I found online that was a huge kind of breakthrough was the story of a woman named Shana Gittle, who was from Kreslov, which is in present-day Ukraine. And at the time, I didn't realize this was one of the towns that we would be focusing on in our book. And she had come, she was part, the book that I found is called And Prairie Dogs Weren't Kosher, which is a hilarious title. But basically, it is the story of these Jewish women who came over from the Pale of Settlement to settle the upper Midwest in the 1890s, and she was one of them. And she was a midwife, she was an herbalist, and the story is told by her granddaughter, who she delivered. And she was able, not even though she didn't speak English or read English, but she was able to go into these pharmacies in I think it was Grand Forks, North Dakota, and pick the herbs off the shelves that were in the jars, and know what they were, even though she couldn't speak or read English, and take the medicine home or the herbs home and prepare it into the medicine that her family needed. And so that was just so just an exciting, very exciting moment for me to realize that, yes, there were herbalists. Yes, there were these women midwives who were so knowledgeable that they didn't even need to know the language that the herbs were being stored and presented in, because the herbs are universal, or, you know, generally speaking. And this was one of my breakthroughs. And mm-hmm. So knowing that she was from Ukraine, I went back to a source that I had been looking at for my monographs and other projects in my class. And the source is about folk medicine in Ukraine. And it's one of the, it is the only source in English that you can find in a library. It was published in 1952. It's an ethnobotany, allegedly, of done in Ukraine. And the research was done between the world wars. So it was done in the 20s. It was published in the United States in the 50s by a woman who survived the war, a Ukrainian woman who survived the war and had brought this suitcase, literally a suitcase of documents with her. And through like agencies that existed during the 50s, she compiled this data into this document. And it's literally a mimeographed document. It's part of a series called the Mimeographed Series, and it's number 21 in that series. And so this is a source that I used for my research because of the plant medicine. But once I found out about Shauna Gittel having been from Ukraine, I realized, you know, that yes, Ukrainians and people in Ukraine who lived around my grandparents, you know, this document is even more important to me. And I had never really looked at who the document was, who had been interviewed for these folk ways in the document, because it doesn't really say, there's no identification of the informants. But in the back of the document, there is a list of the 100 towns where the expeditions went. Wow. In the 20s. And so I, on a whim, I thought, well, I should find out, you know, where they went. And because maybe, you know, some of these towns would have been, you know, where some of my ancestors had lived. And in the document, when she even mentions where the plants were found and the informants came from, she abbreviates them all. So you can't really tell what they are unless you go to the index of the towns in the back. You don't really pay attention to that. So I, on a whim, started to go through that list. And just about every list, every town on the list, my first hit was this website called Jewish Gen, which you might be familiar with.
Mm-hmm. A genealogy
site. Yeah. Yeah. It's one that I've, you know, used many times because, you know, some cousins of mine and I have been working on our family genealogy. And so I was just like, this is weird. And Adam was sitting near me while I was doing this. And I turned to him and I go, do you think this is significant? And you can imagine what he said.
And the rest is history. Yes. And quite. It was all history. Let me jump in. Our guests today are the authors of a new book out there called Ashkenazi Herbalism. It is written by the authors are Dietra Cohen and Adam Siegel. I'm going to change the subject a little bit. And each herb that you found, you present quite extensively what it is, what's it called in several different languages, and how to do it and what to do with it. And I believe there are 26 different herbs that you use?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So first question is, I remember growing up as a kid, my mother became a health food fanatic when I was about 8. And we had a book in our house that I grew up with called simply The Herb Book. I have no idea who wrote it. I have no idea where it is. It probably got thrown out a long time ago. But
is it by John Lust?
Could very well be. It was very thick. It was a paperback. And it was a well-worn
I have that book.
Paperback. And it was like, you're talking, if I was like, you're talking late 60s, early 70s is when it came out.
Right.
But there are hundreds of herbs there. Why? Mm-hmm. My question is, this is sort of like my daughters would probably hit me or something like this. Why only 26 herbs, Dietra?
Well, we had a page limit. And that was a really hard decision for me to make, to pick the herbs that I did. And, you know, I really vacillated on a lot of them. And I should say that the book isn't meant to be a working herbal. It's more of like a historical document because, you know, even herbalism changes over time and, you know, is subject to, you know, developments in science because it is a science. And so many of the herbs are not plants that herbalists would look to today. And, you know, I point that out really directly in some of the monographs where it's appropriate.
Let me ask you about that. So I have my finger open up on Fragraria vesca, which is strawberries.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Strawberry.
First question is, how come you list everything with the Latin name? But I suppose it's more universal to use the Latin name, and it's like the same, same in everything. Okay. So I'm actually quite fascinated that you give the name in English, and then you give the name in Yiddish, and then you give what it's called in Hebrew, and then in Ukrainian, which you can't read, and in German, Polish, Russian, and Lithuanian, okay, which is, that's pretty flipped out, it's way cool. I grew up, my Yiddish is decent, and in my house, strawberries were klubnikis, which I do see as one of them. But you've got you've got 8 different Yiddish words for strawberry. How did you find 8 Yiddish words for strawberry?
Do you want to answer that?
Oh, sure. I can step in. We actually have klubnikis. We have it listed. That was actually one of the fun parts. And the Yiddish was actually easier than the Hebrew. You're helped along. There was a guy named Mordechai Schechter who was like the big Yiddish lexicographer. And he has a couple of really nice dictionaries and glossaries of plant names in Yiddish. And that's one of the reasons that's where the Latin names come in handy. So you know that somebody's talking about this type of, you know, Fragaria vesca as opposed to wild strawberry, which has no the other one. It's well, reversed. There's different strawberries, wild strawberries, and the kind that you get in the grocery store. So he lists some names, and then, as Dietra said, we kind of, you know, really dove deeply into, the library research. There is a 4-volume. It must be 4,000 pages. It's a early 20th century. Reference work by Emanuel Löw, a Jewish German plant historian, and it's called Flora der Juden, Plants of the, you know, Flora of the Jews. And in the appendix, he has in a very tiny type, and I can't remember the term he uses, he calls it jargon. You know, he says, well, here are the plant names that you find in the Old Testament, in the Torah. Here's the plant names that you find in the Talmud. Here's the plant names that we find, you know, in Maimonides. You know, in Hebrew or Aramaic. And then at the end, he's got this chapter called Jargon. And that includes a lot of Yiddish names, which he doesn't put in Yiddish. He has them sort of written out. So we found some things in there. And then just looking around, even recently, since the book came out, we found something kind of interesting about nettles. And there was a, was it, what was it? Yeah, there's a, there, we were looking at a recent work on Hasidic healers, and they refer to something that they called Payelem Bronfen. Now we all know, you know, Bronfen is just, you know, it's like distilled, you know, it's like brandy. It's something that's been a distilled alcoholic beverage. But what was this Payelem? And we looked around and we figured they were using a variation of the Polish term, or one of the Yiddish terms for nettles, which is Poland. It's Artemisia. I beg your pardon. It's Artemisia. Thank you for correcting me. Absinthe.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So, but there are a lot of sources. The Hebrew names were taken from these, you know, 17th century, 18th century Sforim, you know, the Segulis and Refuis, the books of remedies. And a lot of the time, those were rendered as sort of, they took the Latin name and put it in Hebrew letters, and then the spelling would vary. So there's a lot of kind of odd-looking terms that you'll find in the glossary. But that was really fun.
Okay, that's
Yiddish
cool.
was a challenge.
Okay, so now let's stick with strawberries. Okay, so we grow strawberries in our backyard. They don't. This is Michigan, and it's not exactly strawberry. Blueberries do better, but we have strawberries because it's just an easier plant to grow, and Can I take my strawberry leaves and eat them when I'm not feeling well, Deatra?
I don't think it would hurt to put them in a tea. I know that.
Now you sound like my grandmother. It wouldn't hurt.
People
in 100 years ago in Europe had a certain belief that using strawberry leaf tincture or tea would have certain health benefits. And did it? Does it? Or was it just maybe it was something like a they psyched themselves out and it was.
You're saying it's like an old wives' tale, or right. What do you call it? I believe, and I have experienced, and the science even will confirm that plants are they have medicinal qualities. I mean, they are chemically based, and they interact with the human body, which is also chemically based in infinite ways. And what I wanted to say is that even today, you will find that pharmaceutical companies go into indigenous lands and cultures, and they talk to the people there who still use plant medicine to base their pharmaceutical drugs on. And many of the medicines that we know today, like aspirin, is a an artificial compound that's based on chemicals that are found, or constituents that are found in plants like willow or birch or meadow sweet. So no, I don't think it's a passing fancy or a myth. It's true. Right.
Okay, cool. Mm-hmm. This is going to have to do it. And go ahead. I'm finished. Finish up, please.
Oh, I was going to say, the plants are very, very strong, you know, some of them, and to some people, and they interact differently with different people. So it's really, really important to take it very seriously and to, it's not a toy. It's not a game. It's an important part of our history. And if you want to work with plants, you really need to study them and be very respectful of them. And
this has been awesome. Okay, we are out of time for this segment. Again, the book is called Ashkenazi Herbalism. It is written by our two guests, Deatra Cohen and Adam Siegel, available wherever you would buy your Ashkenazi Herbalist book. Will there be a sequel? Is there going to be a volume two? With the
and as a matter of fact, yes. We are working on a second book.
That's wonderful.
Right now.
Okay, that's great.
Yeah.
Okay, we want to thank you both, Adam and Deatra, for coming on, and wish you continued success and keep us apprised of future endeavors.
Thank you so much. It's been our total pleasure.
Okay. Yes, thank you. Thank you. We've really enjoyed ourselves. It's been great. Thank you so much for having us on.
Okay, take care. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Jewish Hour.
Want assurance of quality and excellence in kosher? Look for the Michigan K on the label. What's it look like? The Lower Peninsula of Michigan with a K. It's the symbol of the Michigan Kosher Supervisors. Go to their website, mikosup.com. That's M-I for Michigan, K-O for kosher, and S-U-P for supervisors, mikosup.com, and find this month's featured products. You'll find Michigan K products wherever fine food is sold, especially at Natural Food Patch on West 9 Mile Road in Ferndale.
I'm here, you're listening to The Jewish Hour. Let's listen to, this is brand new, this is Benny Friedman, it's a cappella, it's called Tati, which means dad, my king, referring to God.
I was told to speak to you, Hashem. Maybe you can tell me who I am. I've been lost too long to know where I belong. In the end, my only hope is that you'll hold my hand. How am I supposed to see your path? With so many questions I have to ask. Now I'm standing here alone, I'm losing hope. And in the end, my tears are falling to you, Hashem.
Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurance is accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800. We all know there's an opiate epidemic, but Advanced Rapid Detox has a solution for people addicted to pain pills, heroin, and dependent on Suboxone and Methadone. Advanced Rapid Detox performs detox under sedation in the hospital. Patients sleep through withdrawals and wake up without cravings. Dr. Julia Aronoff and the staff at Advanced Rapid Detox help people restore their lives and the lives of their families. Addiction affects everyone, even in the Jewish community. And Advanced Rapid Detox is there to help. Call 800-603-1813. That's 800-603-1813. Or visit them online at www.advancedrapiddetox.com.
Herr Schulfinman here. You're listening to the Jewish Hour. At the end of the week, Thursday night, Friday, is Lag BaOmer. It is considered a minor Jewish holiday. Minor means that people are allowed to go to work, say, like, not like on the Sabbath or on one of the major holidays like Passover or the Feast of the Tabernacles, Shavuos, or one of those, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur. So, but it's a day of celebrating. What we're doing is we're commemorating two things. First of all, that Rabbi Akiva, who was the father of the oral tradition, had 24,000 students. And one year there was a plague. We know about plagues now. And all 24,000 students died except for five. And the last student died on the anniversary of Lag BaOmer. And the other one is that one of his students, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, many years later, also passed away. And he, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, left in his will that people should celebrate his death because it means he has his life work has been fulfilled. And Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, we're going to tell a story about Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai after this, after the monologue here, was the father of the esoteric wisdom. He compiled the Zohar upon which the Kabbalah is based. And his feet just weren't long enough to hit the ground. He was a very, very, very special person. So we at Jewish Friend are actually going to be doing something live. We are going to be having it celebrated in Israel. It's a national holiday in Israel. And one of the main things they do is they build bonfires. They build huge bonfires. We're going to build something more like a campfire rather than a bonfire. In fact, we're going to build a couple of campfires so that people can be socially distanced, and we're going to have food, of course, and there is a charge. You go to www.jewishferndale.com for required reservations. And what we're billing it as is come celebrate being fully vaccinated. Masks required and social distancing will be observed. The whole business, we want to be safe, but we realize that there are people out there who can go out into the world now. It's not like it was last year where everything was in 2D and I sat in front of a camera and told stories about Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai for an hour. So we're getting there. We're getting back. It's going to be slow before everything's like back to normal, but we're going to get there, God willing. The portion of the week, which I don't have a lot of time to talk about at this point, is the portion of Emor. Could be found in the book of Leviticus and chapter 21 and further. It starts out with what does it mean to be a Kohen, a priest, and then leads in and segues into the various holidays. And one of the holidays which is mentioned there is the time period which we are in now called Sephira, counting the Omer. During temple times, on the second day of Passover, they would offer up a measure of barley, and then they would count today's day one until we get to Torah, until the celebration of the sabbatical year, as the of the Shavuos, of the feast of the Pentecost. And as they did when they left Egypt, that they said, oh, we're going to get to Torah in 49 days. And we're building up and working to it. And it's called Sephira. Sephira means to count. But Sephira also means to shine, like to polish. And what we're supposed to do during this time is polish ourselves up. We've left Egypt. We've left the slave mentality. And each day for the 49 days, there's a specific character trait that we need to improve. And you can go online. There's various different books that talk about each day, because I don't know which day you're listening to this program, so I can't tell specifically about what today would be, because there's lots of days that today could be. You could be listening to this program 9 years after it was recorded, and that's all good, too. But the idea is it's by the time that the holiday of Shavuos comes around, which is March the 16th, I think it's a Sunday night, Saturday night, your personality should be totally different than the way it was during Passover. And I welcome your comments. You can drop me a line, rabbifinman.com. We can discuss this more in private, but we're running out of time. We got an awesome story. Don't go away. You're listening to the Jewish Hour.
Hi, this is Specs Howard. The Specs Howard School of Media Arts is proud to have been a sponsor of the Jewish Hour and bring quality radio programming to the community. While much of the funding comes from its sponsors, listeners like you help keep the Jewish Hour on the air. Please send your tax-deductible donation to the Jewish Hour, 1725 Pinecrest Drive, Ferndale, Michigan, 48220. That's 1725 Pinecrest Drive, Ferndale, Michigan, 48220. Your help is greatly appreciated. Thank you very much.
Herschel Finman here. You're listening to the Jewish Hour. Want to get in touch with me? Drop me a line at rabbifinman.com. And I'll drop you a line back. There's also wonderful things at RabbiFinman.com and also JewishFerndale.com. It's our sister website, and they're all both under the same umbrella of organization, which sponsors the Jewish Hour and Jewish Ferndale and all the other programs that we run. And we'd like you to check them out. And on RabbiFinman.com and as on JewishFerndale.com, there's a very important section called the donations page. And we would like you to go there and make a donation. If you're coming for Lag BaOmer, you could pay for it right there on the website, which is what I'm going to ask you to do if you're going to use a credit card, because that's the only way which I have for taking credit card donations. So if you show up at Jewish Ferndale next Thursday night and you want to pay credit card, you're going to have to do it online. So anyway, but the Jewish Hour has been on air for 25 years, and we need your help, and we want you to please help. So go to RabbiFinman.com, donations, make that donation. We're midway through May. We're midway through May, and money is coming in slowly. What the media broadcast is expensive, and we need your help. So do it today. And by the way, also, it doesn't necessarily have to be a check or a credit card. If you live in like the Detroit area, and you have something of value that you want to get rid of, like a car, a boat, a truck, exercise equipment, land, a house, whatever it is, I just found out now I can take cryptocurrency also, by the way. So if you've got some Bitcoin stuff lying around, yeah, we can take that and we'll put it all to very good use. This story happened in the year 1736. The Baal Shem Tov had just become, 1734, excuse me, had just become a, announced as being a Rebbe. For the first 36 years of his life, first 18 years of his life, he didn't know himself. And then when he was 18, he started learning. And by the time he was 36, he said, okay, I'm opening up. I'm hanging a shingle. And word got around very quickly that he was an amazing wonder worker. In a town, two towns over, I don't know the names of these towns, and they're all the same to me. And when Dietrich Cohen started naming towns, or when Adam Siegel started mentioning names of towns, and I just kind of like went, yeah, they're all east of Crow's Point Farms. This is about the knowledge of my history of the Pale of Settlement and the geography thereof. So the Baal Shem Tov lived in that area also, and so in a town not that far away, there was a man whose daughter was having, they called them then, fits. She was had like a nervous breakdown, and she was wanting to screaming for no reason, and she was incoherent, and it was pretty, they made their lives miserable. So someone told them about the Baal Shem Tov. So he was a very wealthy man. He got into his coach, and he traveled to the town where the Baal Shem Tov was. He was not yet in Mezhebuzh. He was some other town. And the townspeople didn't want him to leave. But he said, I'm going to go, and it's for the benefit of the many, not just the benefit of an individual. The journey was supposed to take just a couple of hours, but they got lost, and it took all night. And they realized that they had to stop in this village. And they came out, they went into a road, you know, to the local inn in the village, in this shtetl. And people were very downcast. What was the problem? The local parrots, the squire, had a daughter who also had gone mentally insane. And he, the squire, the anti-Semite, blamed it on the Jews. And if his daughter didn't get well in 3 days, he was going to expel the Jews, having confiscated all of their properties. And this was like the second day already. So word came around that the Baal Shem Tov was in town. And they convinced the squire to allow the Baal Shem Tov to heal the daughter. And he just said, what kind of, she's another doctor. He's been, nope, he's not a doctor. He's a rabbi. What did he do? He insisted that, first of all, the woman who was like wildly insane, like would beat up anybody who came near her, be restrained in a chair. And he sat down opposite her with a Gemara Me'ila, which is a book of the Talmud, opened up to page 17, and started reading a story about Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. How he had been instructed by the Sanhedrin to go to Rome and have a repeal against that the Romans had levied, that they're forbidding the learning of Torah. When he got there, there was a problem. Caesar's daughter had gone clinically insane, had gone mad, and was also doing the same thing. And Shimon bar Yochai was able to discern that she had been possessed by a demon by the name of Ben-Tamilion. This is where it gets weird, a demon by the name of Ben-Tamilion, yes. So Caesar went, so Shimon bar Yochai said, I can heal your daughter. He said, go ahead, try. So very holy dude, just looked at this girl and said, Ben-Tamilion, leave this girl immediately. And she got better. Okay, the Caesar was so enthralled and so impressed, he said, go around my house and you can take anything that you want. And he found the decree forbidding the Jews to learn Torah and ripped it up right in front of the Caesar. So the Baal Shem Tov then looked at this squire's daughter and said, you're not possessed by Ben-Tamilion, but you need to become normal. And he looked at her straight in the eye. And sure, like her gaze changed. And she was released. And she was better. They then traveled on to this man's house. And the Baal Shem Tov entered the house. And he prayed on behalf of this girl. Please, God, heal this girl. And she was healed in the merit of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. That's going to do it for the show. I want to thank you so much for tuning in. We hope we had a chance to entertain you a bit. We hope we had a chance to educate you a bit. We hope you have a great week. Happy Lag BaOmer. Come to Ferndale if you can on Thursday night. Take care.